We all have familiars, right? All of us?
Yes.
Does everyone have a pet?
We do.
Cat, have you ever been afraid of your pet? What do you have for a pet?
I have two cats. It's a cat household. Marin is terrifying. She's my big fat one, and she doesn't like anything or anyone. And she is currently sitting on my bed staring at me, so that's a little irksome, but we're talking about it right now. They're cute. I think I try to hug them too much, so nobody likes me. Everybody likes Jimmy. Jimmy is like the cat daddy of the households, even though I clean up the poop. So I'm a little bitter, but it's totally fine.
My pets are... Well, I mean, I would say Spike is my 17-year-old Maine Coon cat. I have feared for my life a few times with Spike. I've also, you know, seen Cat's Eye. And, I would say that I fear pets. My dogs have always been very small.
Get small pets so you can overpower them. Trent, Calvin ever threaten you?
No, I've never ever found my 10-pound Pomeranian Mogwai mix to be threatening. I think you, Dave, have the scary pet in this bunch. You have a giant Rottweiler who is young and has a lot of strength and vigor. I would be afraid. I've been afraid. I'll tell you what. I've been afraid of your pet a number of times.
I disagree. I think Dave's dog is like Cat. Dave's dog just has too much love to give, and not everybody wants it.
That's right.
You know, people always... My stepbrother had a big Rottweiler at one point, this is many years ago. And the thing about the big, powerful dogs is that people are always like, oh, but he's a big teddy bear. He's the sweetest thing. And, you know, but all it takes, the thing is, yeah, I'm sure the dog is a big teddy bear. Very harmless. Very nice. Very sweet. Very friendly. Not a mean bone in the body. But all it takes is one thing. It's not like an everyday scare. Sure, the dog's not vicious or anything. One day, 1 minute, 1 second is all it takes. And you are over. Welcome to Speak All Evil, the podcast you were warned about. I am the human Trentipede, here with Coven, Cut, and Grave. Hey guys, how's it going?
Heyo.
Great.
Hello.
This week, this is where my kitty lays. No more he screams and hollers. He lived for 5 and 20 days. He cost me $50. We're talking pets. Cat, what did you bring to the table for pets this week?
I think the first thing that pops into my mind when I think of spooky pets is Pet Sematary. The OG, the 1989 version from Mary Lambert. Obviously, it's a Stephen King story. I don't know if it was a short story or a full one. I feel like it was probably a shorty.
Full novel.
Kind of a big deal.
Did you guys read it? Well, I didn't read it.
Yeah. I read it when I was like 10.
Same.
Well, great. So it's about this doctor, Dr. Lewis Creed, who moves his family to Maine, of course, because that's where all spooky stories take place. And they meet a local man named Jed, who I think is a national treasure. And then after the death of their cat, spoiler alert, the friendly local tells them to bury it in the old pet cemetery, but the result is something sinister. Bump, bump, bump. Sometimes dead is better.
Better.
I remember thinking this movie was a little bit more scary the first time I watched it. And then this time I was just kind of, I don't want to say annoyed. Like I feel like I was kind of annoyed by the guy that played Lewis. He is a very bad crier. Like he's not a good pretend to be sad guy. So that kind of threw me a little bit, but it's definitely got its spooky points still. I think towards the end, it gets, you know, a little spookier. There's some graphic ankle cutting that I still had to look away from on the screen. But I think it's interesting. Like, it's an interesting take on, you know, how people kind of deal with death or tragedy. You know, some people just can't let it go, you know. So I thought it was a fun pet filled film.
I if you want to be scared by Pet Sematary, the best way to do it is to watch the remake and then watch this one, because I think this one's way scarier than the remake. You know, they go back to like the origins of the Pet Sematary into this like weird like gothic pilgrim stuff all the way to present. And I thought the Pascal was also very scary in this one. The college student that haunts him throughout. And the thing I like the best about Pet Sematary, the original, is that it's very Stephen King. I feel like it's almost like from like horror graphic novels or comic books. And I thought that this one definitely had that. Without spoiling too much, you know, Trent and I talked about how comic book, like the final scene is with the kiss, and Judd is very good in this one. A lot of people have problems with his main accent, but I don't think a lot of people realize that the main accent is not really one thing. It kind of varies from county to county, and I think it was believable. I do agree that Lewis was kind of the rest of the actors in this, besides for Herman Munster, were kind of like soap opera actors or like some Cinemax late night kind of stuff.
Star Trek.
Yeah, but I like this one way better than the remake. I think it does justice to the book. I don't know. I this is one of my favorite Stephen King adaptations. I think the stuff that's come after this has not been as true to Stephen King's style.
I enjoyed this one. I hadn't seen it for quite a while. I read this book when I was in like seventh grade or something. So, you know, as far as whether it's faithful or not, or the level of quality of adaptation, I think this is one of my favorite Stephen King stories, generally, for sure. I love the story so much that any adaptation to me is cool. And I think that to me, this is more interesting than good necessarily. I think there are some great things about it. I thought Fred Gwynne's main accent was great. I mean, as somebody who's been watching bad main accents in movies my whole life, I thought Fred Gwynne was really good. And I think that it's a fun, if you like the story and you like Stephen King, I think that it's a fun watch. I did love the like 50s horror comic feel. And this whole setup from the start is very similar to things like Hot Fuzz, the big city MD hospital doctor retires to a small country town. He's going to spend more time with his family. He's got young kids. He's going to be the school doctor on a small college campus and get away from the rat race. Lo and behold, the patient of his life and perhaps death. Kevin, what do you think of this one?
This is one of my favorite Stephen King books for sure. I read it when I was pretty young and then reread it later on in life. It's so terrifying. I'll disagree with Dave a little bit. Neither the 89 version or the 2019 version are totally faithful to the book. In fact, they leave out some pretty key characters. And one character, it's kind of a big deal, kind of a big part of exactly what this Pet Sematary is. But being from Maine, we all worship Stephen King. I worship Stephen King. I love finding anything King-related, and I love finding anything Maine-related. You know, most people in this country think we're part of Canada, so I love seeing anything that puts us on the map. He pulls a total Hitchcock in this, and he cameos as the minister, which is I love seeing Stephen King pop into any of his movies. And one thing that I found, there's a documentary that's free on Tubi called Unearthed and Untold, The Path to Pet Sematary, which is a fantastic hour-long watch. And a lot of the shit I'm going to ramble on today about, I got from this.
So we on this show, we talk a lot about useless male figures in horror movies and how they do nothing. Well, Pet Sematary, I think, is a really good example of where Lewis does too fucking much. And maybe he should have done nothing. The movie itself, I have a lot of problems with. I think the acting is atrocious, other than Fred Gwynne and Miko Hughes, because a 2.5-year-old is the best actor in this movie.
This is true.
The soil of a man's heart is stony, Lewis, and all this.
Good job, bud. That's good.
Yeah, that was very good.
Man grows what he can, he tends to it. Because what you buy is what you own. And what you own always comes home to you.
I've been doing that for about a week. I can't stop. Sorry. But,
very
you know,
well executed.
I was waiting for the Trent Main accent. I'm so happy.
That's your cat now.
Fixed cat don't tend to wander.
You got that real down east old guy main accent. I can do like the mullet, like the guy who like had a fucked up childhood. That guy, I can do that guy. Jesus Christ, dude.
I thought that the gobbledygook about the men's hearts and the secrets and women are supposed to keep the secrets. I don't know all about that stuff. I thought that the real overriding but more subtle theme of this, which is interesting to me, was one of faith. I don't think you usually think of like horror movies in general, and probably not this one right on the surface as a story about faith, but it seemed to me that a big part of this was the fact that the no-nonsense doctor who doesn't believe in the afterlife, who doesn't believe in heaven, who is very matter-of-fact and clinical about matters of death, which is a big part of the movie, was explaining to their daughter Ellie when the cat goes missing. He's the one who cannot accept death. He's the one who becomes obsessed and goes to such great lengths to stave off death because he can't deal with it. And it seems to me that part of his outlook informs the fact that he can't deal with it because he doesn't have faith. He doesn't believe that there's anything more than the life on a table in an office. He doesn't believe in anything beyond the clinical. And so when it comes time for him to deal with human loss and death and dying, he just freaks out. And I feel like it's kind of a message there about believing in something beyond what you can see and feel, and believing that a person might be something more than an insect or an animal that dies and then that's it. And if you reject any notion of that, then I think it could lead you to some pretty dark places.
I would like to have seen the moments that I was talking about where they kind of talk through history of the repercussions of burying animals in this pet cemetery and how it always goes wrong. I wish there was more pet stuff. I would love like a prequel to this that was all gothic with, you know, like just dogs and cats going insane. I feel like a lot of the pet movies, both of them we're talking about this week, deal with a transformation of character in the pet. So like, you know, we've spent 1,000 years weaning domestic animals off their instincts. And then, you know, like the Stockholm syndrome dynamic that you have with a pet, mm-hmm. underlying is that they have these instincts to hunt and to kill and to survive. And that our fears kind of are that these are going to emerge to the surface. You know, there's always that potential. I have the Maine mullet double wide trailer park accent because those are my roots. Mm. And you know, you guys and other people in my life have been spending years domesticating me, but really when it comes down to it, that's where it lies.
It's an ongoing trailer trash.
Like I was the kid with SpaghettiOs all over his face. Even if I hadn't eaten SpaghettiOs in a week or a fudgesicle, it was all over my face all the time. Just came out of my pores.
Dave was born like he came out of the pet cemetery.
Oh.
Yes.
Was it Timmy? You're Timmy Baderman.
Ooh.
I want to talk about the acting. You have Dale Midkiff, who played Lewis. He was terrible. And Allison watched this with me. So the scene where Victor Pascal first shows up and asks Lewis to come with him, and Lewis gets out of bed and he's wearing his scrubs. Allison was like, who the fuck comes back from the hospital and goes to bed in their scrubs? Like, wouldn't you put your pajamas on or something? So as I'm researching the movie...
Yeah, that wouldn't fly during coronavirus for sure.
Yeah. As I'm looking up the movie, I find out that in the book, he's supposed to just be in jockey shorts. Well, the people on set thought he looked too hot, as in attractive, while they were trying to film this scene. So they just grabbed whatever they had close by, and that was his scrubs.
That's one of your great facts so far, Kevin.
Is it?
I just want to say, yeah, that Lewis was too hot, and they had to put some more clothes on him.
He could have been Daddy of the Week, but not with those scrubs.
I think Judd is Daddy of the Week for me.
Mego Hughes is the kid that played Gage Creed. This kid was 2.5 years old. He is the best actor in the film by far. Ellie, the daughter, played by twins, Blaise Berdahl and her sister Beau. Sorry to both of you. You were fucking irritating and terrible. You almost ruined the entire fucking movie. You're lovely in the documentary. You look like you grew up well and adjusted. And it's common for child actors to be played by twins. So the studio was pushing Mary Lambert and King, who had a hand in this movie, a big hand, to cast twins. And when Mego Hughes came in, they said, look, this kid is way too good. So a lot of the reasoning for twins is you have child labor laws. So you can't work a kid on a movie shoot for 16 hours straight. So they want one twin for 8 hours, the other twin for the other 8. He is also the kid from Kindergarten Cop that gave us the legendary line, boys have a penis and girls have a vagina.
Wow.
And then he also plays the kid in Wes Craven's New Nightmare. So in this weird universe moment, Heather Langenkamp, Nancy, who was also in New Nightmare, plays his mom. Well, the guy doing effects on Pet Sematary was her boyfriend at the time. So she actually flew to Maine to hang out with him. He proposed in Maine, and then he kept calling her to get advice on how to gain the trust of this little kid, Mego Hughes. And then all these years later, they come together and work on New Nightmare. And he's phenomenal in that as well, by the way.
What was so annoying about Ellie, who's like hardly in this, and then they just send her off to the grandparents' house so they don't have to
her
do anything with the character?
Her whining was pretty annoying.
Her whining is like, you know, not my cow, tell God to get his own cat. It was just not. What? I mean,
I would want to tell her that her cat was dead.
Oh my God.
Like, if you want something, ask me for it. I will give it to you. But you don't need to be like, I want a beach ball. Like, don't do that. It's not going to get me to respond.
She was trying to save the day. She was the one getting all the spooky dreams. She was coming in hot. Yeah. You guys were just shutting her down. I didn't think she was that bad.
I never noticed this, but there was a big The Shining vibe in this movie. Where I think King, and it's been a few years since I read the book, but I'll have to go back. I think King was hinting at this family that multiple members of it had The Shining.
Oh.
Interesting.
Well, that's true because, right, they're getting messages from beyond. Mm-hmm. But I think that, okay, that's a good point, actually. And that, to me, that's something that Stephen King does a lot of that I don't love about his work. I'm a huge fan, read his books all growing up, love me some Stephen King, but that is a problem that I have with a lot of his stories. He sets up all this great human drama and all these great themes, and he has all this really cool horror type stuff going on, but at the end of the day, so often it just comes down to this inexplicable random, often this is called like Ghost in the Machine, just some totally unexplainable supernatural thing gets him out of any question, like, why does this happen? Why does that happen? Why are they suddenly speaking to a dead guy? Why are the woods talking? Like, it just comes down to like, I don't know. Scary, you know, there's nothing else to it.
I disagree. I think he has spent his career forming the Stephen King universe. And that if you were to take an entire wall of your house and start to connect the dots, you would find that he actually is constantly building on this universe and referencing himself. And I think the problem when you have such a body of work And I also think a problem with having him write the screenplay for this is it's hard to be objective. You have so much in your head that you understand that sometimes it can be hard to convey that to the audience. And as King goes on and is still writing novels, you can get further and further away from a casual reader enjoying something. You know, it's almost to the point where you have to be a hardcore investigative Stephen King reader to maybe start to understand some of his works. And I appreciate that.
I would say like 2017, it's just a guess, but there was kind of a resurgence of Stephen King stuff. But I felt like the early 80s and even late 70s was a heyday for his cinematic work. And not that he has a ton of, you know, input in every movie, but that was like the heyday. And at this point, when Pet Sematary came out, he had kind of not really been owning the horror cinema for a little while. This was kind of a return to form. You know, it reminded me a little bit of, if it was all tightened up, it could have been a Creepshow episode.
Yeah, that's actually, they talk about that in the documentary that Kevin referenced, Unearthed and Untold, The Path to Pet Sematary on Tubi. They talk about the fact that this movie almost didn't get made because the studios felt that Mary Lambert had shopped it to at least one studio before the one that made it. And they were saying that, Stephen King movies are passe. Stephen King is over. Nobody wants more Stephen King. There's already been a ton of these adaptations. Some have been good, some have been bad, but they felt like the time had passed broadly, and then there was a writer's strike. So it was mid to late 80s in Hollywood. So then suddenly they were looking for stuff that was already written, that you already had a screenplay, you already had a script prepared, and they could just bang it out and make this movie. So that's where Mary Lambert got her chance to have this made.
Yeah, and it's crazy. King, this was supposed to be George Romero. King actually sold the rights to this to George Romero for a whopping $10,000. And I think we talked about in the Carrie episode, didn't he sell the rights to that for like $2,500 or something? So, but the reason that he was sort of underselling the rights is he had a lot of say. So he had final director say. So he's the one that picked Mary Lambert. He also had a stipulation in the rights selling that said this 100% had to be filmed in Maine, which is super dope. So this whole thing was filmed in Sedgwick, Ellsworth, and Mount Desert Island. And I wish I knew that, because I totally would have made us take a Speak All Evil Company outing trip to Mount Desert Island, because an abandoned rock quarry still exists where they built the Pet Sematary scene. And I fucking would have loved that. In fact, that's where we should go camping.
I'd love to talk about Maximum Overdrive someday on the show that he actually directed and later disowned. But some of the source material, though, even is just, it stretches believability a little bit. Things like we were talking about, they're trying to tell Ellie what happened with the cat, and this idea of dealing with death with your kids and explaining death to them. There's this whole tension between the parents, between Lewis and his wife, about how they're going to approach this with their kids. And beyond that, there's a tension in what they each believe about death and the afterlife. And it's like they've never talked about this before. I mean, they're married with two kids. You'd think that at some point she would have found out that Lewis doesn't believe in life after death, like that she just discovers that because a cat dies. They never, in all their dating and courtship and marriage, they never discussed bigger ideas that they have about life and death. Also, the Zelda thing, which I had totally forgotten about Zelda. When I saw the remake of this movie last year, I thought that they just made up Zelda for the remake. I was like, what is this shit? This wasn't in the book. Well, it was in the book. I just forgot about it. I didn't remember. But another thing, she tells Lewis the whole Zelda story. Wouldn't you think they would have talked about that at some point? At some point,
That's what I thought.
He would have found out, like, oh, you had a sister who died of spinal meningitis, and you carry guilt your whole life because it was such a traumatic experience. That's never come up this whole marriage. What?
That's not pillow talk.
She's not dropping the whole thing on him. She's coming clean about Zelda's death. And this is this part of the story is actually making both of your points that this entire movie is about avoiding death. And clearly Rachel, the wife, has avoided death because of this issue with her sister Zelda, which I don't necessarily know that spinal meningitis turns you into an absolute fucking lizard monster, but I don't know how you forgot that, Trent. That fucked me up when I was a kid and I first saw this movie. That terrified me. And fun fact, the young Rachel, played by Elizabeth Jurenik, a Waynefleet grad, was really good friends with one of my best friends, and I used to party with her.
Ooh.
Get Stephen King on the show, bro.
She would show up at our apartment that we shared with a royalty check and be like, yo, Pet Sematary was just shown on CBS last week, so I got like $2.63. Let's party.
Wow.
I was a little bit betrayed by finding out that Zelda was played by a man.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was kind of like when I was... You know, I remember when the Love Shack, the B-52's Love Shack video was out, I was really attracted to RuPaul, who later I found out was a man. It was a similar dynamic with me and Zelda. I had been attracted to Zelda for years, dream girl.
And sexuality then I find out spectrum. That
she's played by a man.
Hold on, I got to add this to the list of things Dave would have sex with.
No kink shaming on this show. Normalize spinal meningitis attraction. Okay? You can take anything from this episode.
So, Dave, the reason that they went with a man is because they felt that a 13-year-old girl couldn't be scary. What do you have to say about that?
Oh, yeah, they can definitely be scary.
Did you guys catch the Cujo poster when they're carrying Victor Pascal into the clinic after the accident? They run him by a poster of Cujo.
I didn't notice that.
I did have to Google if Cujo was buried in the pet cemetery, because I was like, that makes sense. That'd be really cool. And I was like, oh, no, they're just separate. They're just separate things.
That's another Stephen King hallmark that can get a little, like, he invented the evil inanimate object, you know? Like, what if a pencil was just evil? Master of horror.
Oh, no, not really.
Wait, get this. Hold on, Kevin, get this. What if the chair... was evil. Master of horror. Oh my
God. He actually, I think Dave just mentioned that this could have been an episode of Creepshow. Pet Sematary, Stephen King has acknowledged, was inspired by Monkey's Paw, a 1909 book by W.W. Jacobs. And Shudder's new Creepshow has an episode based on Monkey's Paw. And it's you can, just by watching that, you can kind of tell, you know, where King got the idea. But the Pet Sematary is real, and I always wondered about the spelling of Pet Sematary, because obviously it's intentionally spelled wrong as the title of the book. So King was living in Orrington, Maine on a busy road. His daughter's cat was actually killed by a truck on that road, and the wheels started turning. Well, a neighbor had a Pet Sematary behind her house, and in the documentary, she's sitting behind the original sign. So they were building this pet cemetery because so many pets were dying on the road. And they asked their friend Johnny, okay, your task as we build the cemetery is go get some black spray paint and paint the sign. And Johnny apparently was challenged with spelling and spelled Pet Sematary that way. So that sign really exists. And that's where King got the idea and got the spelling of it. And again, that's right in Maine. I love it.
We should straighten out, speaking of the Pet Sematary, we should straighten out something here because it's pretty important in the horror canon, especially in the 80s. The Pet Sematary itself is not what brings things back. There's another cemetery beyond the Pet Sematary that is, hold on to your hats, you'll never guess, an ancient Indian burial ground. This is a major thing that runs through a lot of 80s movies. We're going to be, in a future episode, we're going to be talking about Toby Hooper. We're going to talk Poltergeist. But I thought it was interesting that this movie does have the Indian burial ground, but most people think of Poltergeist as having the Indian burial ground, when that is actually what's known as the Mandela effect. Are you guys familiar with the Mandela effect?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So most people think that Poltergeist had the Native American burial ground the house was built on, caused all the problems. It was just a regular burial ground. This movie goes the full distance and has the local Mi'kmaq. It kind of weaves in the Wendigo legend or something.
The book does. The movie leaves it out.
Okay, so it's in the new one. Then I've watched three Pet Sematary movies in the past week, so now they're all starting to blur together a little bit.
I'm bummed that they left the Wendigo out. I don't want to get into it. I think we'll save that for some bonus content. But it definitely explains that this is not an ancient Indian burial ground. That's actually untrue. And it sort of explains why the tribe left this land and how the Wendigo owns this land.
What do you mean it's not? It explicitly is. They buried bodies there. I mean, that's what it is.
I think what you're implying, or people maybe infer by what you're saying, that the Indian tribe had something to do with the curse. And that's not the case. It's purely the Wendigo. This is the Wendigo's land. And what a Wendigo does is it influences and possesses and takes over, typically, men. And thus, the tribe realized this land is owned by the Wendigo. We're out.
By the way, I'd just like to point out, the cat gets it twice. The dog gets it twice. The kid gets it twice. I love the thing I love about the Pet Sematary is you kill him once and you get to kill him again. Like, that's probably like what I would do, is I would just use the Pet Sematary to just like, oh, this time we're gonna kill him with a chainsaw, this time we're gonna kill him with an ice pick.
I've always wanted to try a lawnmower.
Well, we're talking about pets. I decided to go with the ultimate pet movie, albeit non-traditional pets. I chose Gremlins,
yes.
The 1984 Steven Spielberg blockbuster, directed by Joe Dante, who we talked about back in the So Bad It's Good episode. He directed Piranha, the late 70s. He also had done The Howling by this point. A movie, this Gremlins, written by Chris Columbus. So right away, you've got an all-star smash cast. Then, the actual cast of the film, just an 80s dream, headed up by C. Thomas Howell, with Phoebe Cates.
No, Zach Galligan.
You got Corey Feldman. And if that's not enough, you got Judge Reinhold. I mean,
C. Thomas Howell's not in this movie.
Could you want from an 80s film? I hear a bunch of noise going on, and I'm going to address the various groans from the crowd here in a second. It's not C. Thomas Howell. It's Gilligan something, Zilligan or whatever. But the thing is, if you watch this mid-80s Spielberg, Chris Columbus, Joe Dante movie with Phoebe Cates, Judge Reinhold, Corey Feldman, and others, if you just pretend that guy is C. Thomas Howell, it just makes it that much better. He looks just like him. You can even pretend he's the guy from American Werewolf in London if you wanted. But I chose C. Thomas Howell. If you think of this movie and you just watch it like I did and you just think, oh, man, C. Thomas Howell, this is like his best out of everything, it just kind of makes it more enjoyable. So I watched it thinking C. Thomas Howell. I love this movie. It is tremendous. I got way into it. I watched the sequel, Gremlins 2, The New Batch. Love it. Can't say enough about this movie. It's a great pet movie.
Mm.
There's also the cast that you talked about, Trent, in terms of who was behind the scenes. There's a lot of Roger Corman connections here. So I don't think it's a coincidence that we get this family-friendly horror movie, if you will. This was one of my favorite movies of all time. I absolutely bought into the gizmo craze. This is also the first scary movie that I ever got my daughter to watch. This was how I started dipping her toes into the pool of horror. Because it starts off like, this is the cutest movie ever. I love all these characters. Hey, it's Christmas time. This is great. And then death and destruction. Love it. I think the one cast member that you did not just highlight is Hoyt Axton, who plays the dad, the crazy, terrible inventor, Rand Peltzer. He's also the narrator. He's the one that finds Gizmo and starts the wheels in motion. And then also the mom,
Frances Lee McCain, who plays Lynn Peltzer, is unbelievable. I didn't realize until I started looking into this movie that she was basically all of our 80s moms. She was the mom in Gremlins, in Footloose, in Back to the Future, in Stand By Me, and then she made a triumphant return in Scream as Tatum's mom. So Frances Lee McCain, shoot. Mommy of the Week.
This movie scared the shit out of me when I was little. Like, I remember I had nightmares all the time. I distinctly remember my sister, my older sister, is a bit of a piece of shit. Or she was when we were growing up. She's fine now. But I remember we were renting this beach house, like, for a winter rental on, like, York Beach. And there were bunk beds in it. And it didn't matter if I was on the top, if I was on the bottom. If I was on the top, she would stick her little hand up the side and be like, "Gremlins!" And then grab me. If I was on the bottom, she would, like, throw things at me and yell, "Gremlins!" She terrorized me. But this film is what started the terrorization. It's definitely one of my favorite Christmas movies. I always watch it at Christmas time because I like to feel the spirit of Christmas in my heart. And I don't know. I think it holds up. It absolutely holds up. I think my favorite favorite scene is, like, the bar scene, like, when they're all in there and they're, like, breakdancing, and the puppets just look so weird when they're, like, walking on their own. Like, there's no CGI in this movie, you know? I think it holds up and I love it, and I would watch it 1,000 times. It was a fun week for me. I'm glad I got to watch Gremlins.
I love Gremlins too. I would argue that you said it's not a traditional pet movie, but I think it's an allegory for traditional pets, because I feel like the Mogwai is a puppy and I feel like the Gremlins are a cat.
That makes sense.
Because they definitely have the personality of a cat, the mischievous, like, fucking with you kind of vibe. Yeah. Gremlins is great. I like how violent it is. I like that it's the loophole, to terrifying children with, like, oh, it's a kid's movie, let's watch this, and then it's completely terrorizing their brains the whole time. I don't know if anyone else noticed, but if you're a Breaking Bad fan, the deputy in this is Mike from Breaking
Bad.
Yeah. And, like, yeah, he's like,
he's got some hair.
Looks like he might be in his 20s and he's got some hair. And I liked Mike. Was one of my favorite characters on Breaking Bad, so, like, I just started cheering when I realized that he was the deputy sheriff in this movie.
Yeah, they spared nothing with the casting on this. Dick Miller's in it, you know, RIP, he passed away last year as Murray Futterman. You know, he was in Piranha, The Howling, Terminator, Chopping Mall, Night of the Creeps. This week is definitely a tale of two child actors. You have Miko Hughes, who played Gage Creed in Pet Sematary, who grew up to be well-adjusted, very multi-talented. Mm-hmm. And then you have Corey Feldman, who definitely spent a lot of years being a massive fuck-up, although he was in one of the best Jason movies, so there you go. And Hoyt Axton, who I talked about, he actually wasn't even an actor. He improvised most of his lines. What Hoyt Axton is known for is being a massive songwriter, and he also passed away in 99. But he wrote Joy to the World that Three Dog Night made famous. He wrote The Pusher that Steppenwolf made famous in the movie Easy Rider. He has a ton of songs to his. I mean, Jeremiah Was a Bullfrog. The dad from Gremlins wrote that.
What?
I was blown away.
That's funny.
And I never knew that Howie Mandel did the voice of Gizmo until we watched it this week.
Oh,
and I looked it up.
Well, I would take Dave's allegory one step further now that I think about it. The Mogwai, if the Mogwai is the puppy, you didn't follow the rules, you didn't take good stewardship of the puppy, and the Gremlin is an ill-behaved, crazy dog. You can't have people over for dinner with a goddamn dog in there doing stuff, tearing stuff up, taking people's food, might bite someone, getting snappy. Can't have the kids around. That would be my allegory. Oh, by the way, speaking of pets, this is not a PETA-friendly movie. I don't think that PETA would approve of much that goes on in this movie. There's a lot of bad behavior around pets, from the cavalier way that the Mogwai is bought right away. First thing, imperialist capitalism strikes, baby. coming in, a big, fat, rich American, throwing his money around and not taking any responsibility for what he did and ruining something from another culture, which later on in the next movie is destroyed altogether. So I think there's a lot of allegory and commentary going on.
Joe Dante birthed generations of horror fans by tricking us into thinking that this was a family movie, which the studio definitely helped him do by making gizmo toys and dolls.
Mm-hmm.
We all need to thank Joe Dante because this movie did scare the shit out of me. And I think you have two camps. I think there are people that watched this movie when they were young and they got scared, and now they have a serious aversion to horror. And then you have us, who probably watched this movie, got super scared when we were little, and went, huh, wonder what else is out there. So I need to thank Joe Dante for introducing me to the world of horror. And the fucked up thing about Gremlins, first of all, Chris Columbus writing it is insane to me, because that dude wrote Goonies. He's now a major director doing like Harry Potter films. This is the dude that did Home Alone. So that is crazy to me. But his first script was actually darker. There were more deaths. There were heads being thrown downstairs. There was a family dog being consumed. And there was a scene that they wouldn't shoot, which I wish they had, where the gremlins decide to hit up a McDonald's and eat people instead of Big Macs.
This birthed a lot of horror fans, but it also birthed a lot of copycat movies. The main one that comes to mind is like Critters.
Yes.
But it almost started a genre based on crazy little creatures that not just murder, but it's just mischief and torment. And they're almost like drunk college kids in the old port, just like trying to start fights.
Some of us have been watching In Search of Darkness, the 80s horror. Not really a documentary, but it's kind of a look at 80s horror that's on Shudder right now. And I totally forgot about the movie Ghoulies.
Mm-hmm.
Remember Ghoulies?
Yeah. That yes. Like, yes.
Wish I had time. I was so busy watching all of these. There's so many movies associated with this week that I didn't have time to watch Ghoulies, but I am going to, because I'm pretty sure I saw it, and that was like the ultimate Gremlins budget bin knockoff. Like, yeah, Gremlins, how about Ghoulies? I don't know, come out of the toilet, whatever.
Yeah. I'm wondering, you know, how lucky we really need to remember we were in 1984, because Gremlins came out the same day as Ghostbusters.
Oh.
And yes. Ghostbusters is actually the first movie that I ever saw in a movie theater. I remember driving into the main mall theater's parking lot when it still existed and being so excited. I felt like I was in New York City going to like a Broadway play, because I was seeing my first movie on the big screen. It was Ghostbusters. It wasn't Gremlins. But, I mean, to have those two gems come out on the same day is incredible. And they both obviously went gangbusters at the box office. This was a massive hit. You can look up, you know, the fact that they made this movie for $11 million. It made over $200 million at the box office.
Crazy.
But this was the height of home video. And Gremlins made hundreds of millions of dollars on VHS. I don't know if Laserdisc was a thing then, whatever, Who Framed Roger Rabbit. But This is a massive, massive hit, and I'll throw out the obvious fact. This movie, as well as Temple of Doom, are purely responsible for the PG-13 rating. So yes. This movie, when it came out, was rated PG. Mm-hmm. It was marketed as, look at Gizmo, he's so cute. Tons of parents brought
toys, look at all the four, toys. You
yeah,
buy
all of
kids.
It. 4, 5, 6-year-olds into this movie. And I just can't – I still remember the first time I saw this movie and the science teacher was murdered. And mm-hmm. I was horrified. So you had parents walking out of the theater in droves. The studios were pissed. And Steven Spielberg himself is the one that recommended, let's go with the PG-13. And Red Dawn was actually the first movie ever officially released with a PG-13 rating.
Mm. I think we need to talk about the absolutely child scarring Christmas story that Kate tells about her dad.
Yeah. Like,
that was
Phoebe Cates.
Oh my god, it was like when I heard that also scarred me. I was just like, wait, he died? Like, this isn't a Christmas movie at all, but it's a good Christmas movie.
Yeah, you have to be careful of this one because you want to show it to kids, but it definitely does the spoiler of Santa's not real.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, good call. Good call. I actually, wow, I didn't even realize I was doing that when I watched this with Nora. She definitely still believed in Santa. Oh, shit.
Oh, no.
Yeah, this was controversial for that reason as well, because it is a Christmas movie, as you noted, Kat. One of the things that happens in this movie that was controversial around the Christmas theme was the speech that you mentioned, Kat. Phoebe Cates' character teaches Billy about sad Christmas. So that's another element. Not only do you have this cute gizmo come on and the toys and the stuffed animals telling you to bring the kids, but not only is there hyper violence and, you know, pets being blown up in microwaves, but you have Billy learning about sad Christmas. He's a grown man, but somehow he doesn't know that some people, he can't fathom that some people might not like Christmas for whatever various reasons. And Phoebe teaches him all about sad people on Christmas, which resonated with me big time, you know, especially at the time and still now. I don't know if I ever told you guys that my dad left my family on Christmas Eve.
Nuh-uh.
And he just never came home from work. And we couldn't, his work didn't know what happened to him. We just like freaked out for like a week. We didn't hear from him, just nothing, no note, no calls. The cops are looking for him. And then it was right after New Year, we were like a major cold snap, and we went to have a fire in the fireplace. And something like the smoke was blowing back in the house. It was like something in the fireplace. And we thought it was like a dead animal or something like that. I had to have the fire department come, and it was my dad. He was dressed as Santa. He had presents.
So
he snapped
you.
His neck. He died instantly.
You had me for a good 30 seconds, and I was like, oh my God,
Trent
is telling, oh, I feel like I'm finally feeling connected with Trent and these emotions. And then you son of a bitch.
The studio and Spielberg wanted that entire story she told about her dad cut from the movie. Joe Dante had to fall on the sword and basically say, fuck you guys, that has to stay in here. And he won. And I think it's great. And, you know, Trent just mentioned Billy. Zach Galligan, not C. Thomas Howell, is how old and still living with his parents and still acting like a teenager? It's a little weird.
I think I'm assuming he's not too far out of high school, and he's got the job at the bank. He's still at home, so he's grown. Yeah. But
well, Reinhold said he was like 20. He's like, I'm the youngest. I'm 22, and I'm VP at the bank. You could be like me. Boo, 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 boo. So I feel like he's
right.
At least
yeah.
22.
He's very naive.
But maybe he's helping. You know, his dad's not raking in a lot of bills or a lot of money with that. You know, with all those inventions, so maybe he's just there to help. You know,
yeah, I love that aspect of it. The inventions that don't work, and the whole family's just using the prototypes for making breakfast.
Smokeless ashtray. Yeah.
But Billy's best friend is an 11-year-old. Corey Feldman's character is in middle school.
They're best friends?
That was also weird. Yeah, that was also weird. I thought.
Well,
why is he best friend?
Feldman's been saying it for years, guys.
Oh,
Cat.
I'm just saying.
Canceled. Not what? Funny.
I didn't think it was funny. I'm being serious.
Hey, we talked about the music in Jaws. And so I was paying attention this week, another Spielberg produced flick. I love the music in this one. I think it's perfect. Like it almost reminded me of the soundtrack of Jaws. But this is a much more appropriate setting for a film score like this. And it was Jerry Goldsmith that did it. He also did the music for Poltergeist, which is cool.
Oh.
What about the effects? Let's talk effects, because obviously this movie had some stop motion. It had a lot of puppeteering. I don't think there was any CG. The giant scene where all the gremlins are rushing down the street may have been CG.
So
I'm not sure that one... I remember it when I was younger being like horrified and amazed at this. It doesn't hold up quite as well now, but
What did you guys think in terms of how they pulled off all the effects in this?
Loved it.
Yeah,
I
thought it was great.
Loved the practical effects.
Like Kat said, the bar scene especially is very, very memorable.
There's a lot of homages to other horror movies. There's a lot of this is kind of self-referential in some ways. It's definitely referential of pop culture at the time. There are a lot of little Easter eggs. Anybody notice the Road Warrior poster egg?
No.
Yeah, Billy has the Road Warrior poster in his bedroom. There's also the scene where they're watching Invasion of the Body Snatchers, the original Invasion of the Body Snatchers, the pods, while the gremlin pods are growing. So there's a lot of stuff like that to look for, almost too much really to notice at all.
Yeah. It's like that moment when you're like watching that movie, like maybe look to your right and see the pods that are in the room and be like, oh, wait, what's happening here?
We haven't even talked about Miss Deagle.
Is that the crotchety old lady?
Yes. So Polly Holiday plays Miss Deagle. She played Flo from the show Alice, which was wildly popular back in the day. She's actually the woman that coined the phrase, kiss my grits.
Oh,
I love
cute.
Her. And as I was reading reviews of the film and going through like all the way back to from 1984 until present day, how critics viewed the movie, her character got so much criticism. I love it. She reminded me of the mean old lady from The Wizard of Oz. Mm-hmm. In fact, as I watched the movie, I was like, they must have modeled her after that. Like, she wants to go after the dog. She's a property manager. And so watching it again, you notice the one time they show her real estate company sign, the hours of business are 10:30 to 11:15 a.m. Monday through Friday.
I didn't notice that.
Same.
Trent, you mentioned Ghoulies. The cool thing about Ghoulies, and I even remember like lots of sequels, like Ghoulies Go to College even is one. But it's like Gremlins, but there's tons more sexy time, I noticed. So like when we were like little kids, we could throw on Ghoulies and be like, yeah, mom, it's like Gremlins. It's just these little creatures, these little Muppets. And meanwhile, you know, we're inside a sorority house viewing Ghoulies be extremely freaky. So I like the spinoffs that this movie made. I thought it was really cool that...
Was the first Ghoulies the one with the castle?
I don't remember.
I don't remember any details. I just remember the cover, the Ghoulie coming out of the toilet is all I remember. I know I saw it.
They were like just a ruder version of Gremlins.
Yeah, right. Edgier. That was probably PG-13.
It was boobs and more blood.
Yep.
Speaking of boobs, this is the second week in a row we've had zero boobs.
Ugh.
We're basically we're a PG podcast now.
Oh my god.
Take that E away.
Oh god, we're gonna go 3 for 3.
All right.
We're gonna hat trick boobless.
I appreciated that once the gremlins hatch, the bad gremlins arrive, this movie doesn't try to take off in a bunch of plot points, a bunch of contrivances and convoluted story about a lot of movies like this. Once the evil gremlins show up, you'd have some stupid story about like they'd have some thing they're trying to do or whatever. In this movie, they just show up and they just start wreaking havoc on the town. There's no overarching plot. Nobody's trying to save the world. Nothing, you know, they're not trying to, like, do anything that they wouldn't do. They're just going crazy, running amok, trying to kill everyone. And the only plot is that you got to stop them. And the only way to stop them is just to kill them with no mercy, no hesitation. There's beheadings with microwaves, whatever you have to do, electrocutions, explosions. There's just, you have to just stamp them out in a pretty brutal fashion.
The kitchen scene with the mother, with Mommy of the Week, Lynn Pelzer, is one of my favorite of all time. When she just goes full Rambo on a bunch of gremlins. And up until that point, she has been the sweetest, meek, kindest mother. And to see her absolutely snap and just do... You have like an entire Final Destinations movie worth of creative deaths in 3 minutes. I love it.
And also, like, she was not tipped off that they were even like evil. They were just in her kitchen, like kind of making a mess. At that point, she didn't know anything about the gremlins. She kind of like just happens upon them and goes full Rambo mode on them for no reason other than they're just messing with their kitchen. And I think that's enough for a mom.
Yeah, I was surprised how like she didn't even try to suss out the situation at all. She just went ham, no questions asked, immediately extreme prejudice.
These things, like, yeah, wow. Need to die.
That's what I like.
I never realized how meta the sequel was. It's super fun to watch, especially if you just watched the first Gremlins.
I might watch it too.
They definitely make fun of themselves a lot. Mm. But while we're on the pets episode, I do have to call out Barney the dog in this movie, whose real name is Mushroom, which is a great name for a dog. This dog was also Lance Henriksen's dog in the movie Pumpkinhead. So nice job, Mushroom the dog, being in two legendary horror films.
Poor dog.
He's R.I.P. probably. That was so long ago.
Yeah, probably.
He's dead.
That's true. Yeah, solid point.